came blowing in, Lord, and all I wanted was to shout out loud. But a bitter wind carries any mournful sound, and the one I'm sure to make if they find me.
An okay place to fade. Let me put Zara to bed. Thank you, Zara. Where was that written? In Barcelona? This is an automated program, the folk and country folder. Though that stuff at the beginning. Well, anyway, let's kick it with My Name's Paul Muth. This is the show News from Neptune, the radio edit. And it's going to be Cops of the World and Cops of Chicago today, I guess. I'm trying to get some more info about the ACLU event this coming Tuesday, speaking of cops, mass incarceration, the animations, and a woman whose story is animated in these short films. This is a nationwide thing. They're doing this all over the country. And there's a local discussant group. And anybody associated with the ACLU, the About on the Facebook page, which is where they recommend finding out about it. Doesn't have that info yet. Free screenings of three animated films and participate in a discussion on repairing our broken criminal justice system. Take one step beyond the first step, as it was called. All right. The Intercept is providing a couple of things today. Well, more than a couple. Jeremy Scahill has an interesting collage on American Empire, as it were, the continuity. Vijay Prashad on a few subjects. We won't get to all of it today. Perhaps I'll play it all tomorrow. He was on campus, and I got to meet him. Didn't go out to drink with him afterwards like I should have, but anyway, it was kind of an afternoon event. MillerCom and all speaking on Russian Revolution. Some amazing bits of history. From that era. It was on the anniversary thereof, 100th year anniversary of the Russian Revolution. I've been at Trinity College in Connecticut. Okay, the other Intercept thing is I'm going to play one of these podcasts that reads an article written by former denizen of Champaign-Urbana. I'm doing a Braden fade here, Sarah Lazar. And a co-author based out of Chicago, I think, now. And she'd been doing work with In These Times, but she has an Intercept article on the Chicago Police Department and their implicit bias instructors who have had challenges to their own actions in not exemplary instructors, in other words, is the thesis of the article. Urbana, I hope, still doesn't get their crisis intervention training up in Chicago. They had been. Not a great place to learn that, it seems to me. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Usual format is a couple of short essays to kick it off while I'm getting it together. I got in a little early, and if you're expecting to hear Higher Ground with Ammons's Carolyn Aaron, they couldn't make it today. I'm hoping things are going okay for them. So, the ACLU event, did I give a time and date? It's at the Art Theater. That's actually the where part of the W's. It's on Tuesday this coming, already the 12th. And the time is here somewhere. Yeah, 7 to 9. And like I said, local discussants. But I haven't gonna message them and see if we can get that information in, because I will be announcing it again tomorrow when I'm probably playing the rest of Vijay Prashad, and we'll see what else Pacifica and associated independent producers are doing to try to address the plight. What was the Daily News headline? Bezos exposes Pecker. Bezos, who was referred to as Bozo by Trump in some time ago, I knew I'd seen an alert about an article in the Times, and I kept it around because I wanted to get back to it. And then I couldn't find the bloody thing. It was in the business section, but it chronicles the beginning incipient part of this story. New York Times writer was on McNeil Lehrer. No, it's not McNeil anymore. Lehrer's still in the production or something. It's his business, along with some others, last I heard. But the Liar Hour, I'll still call it that. The business reporter who covered it was on talking about it, and this didn't get to some of the really intriguing parts of it, accused extortion. How did they get those? That's what Bezos has plunked his money down to investigate. There are allegations that it may have been leaked out of the IC, the intelligence community, in some way. The Washington Post was always quite friendly to the CIA. Going back to Katharine Graham days, you can find interesting quotes on that. Some things the American people just shouldn't know. Okay. But it's an intriguing story, isn't it? If you haven't followed it, it's salacious. It's appropriate to the Trump era. Connects with Trump. Yeah, he had this celebratory tweet on the National Enquirer getting the story on one of his nemesis. We're getting, his firm Amazon is getting a lot of money from the CIA. They run the cloud storage for the CIA since everything's contracted out these days. That's one of the reasons, besides their labor practices, that I look askance at anyone that actually deals with Amazon. You can go elsewhere. Maybe not for their production on. Anyway, I'm going on much too long here. Here's Mumia Abu-Jamal, a little dated perhaps, but I'm sure there's some salience here.
After over a month of the partial government shutdown, President Trump threw in the towel, vowing to an avalanche of political and economic disaster. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco emerged as Trump's most powerful political protagonist since his election. She quietly stood her ground, ignoring his bombast, until he ceded his hold over the shutdown and gave in. Some 800,000 federal workers faced truly challenging conditions after losing checks for two pay periods. Trump officials, some of the richest people in the U.S., snorted derisively over the workers' pay problems. They seemed to echo Marie Antoinette during the French Revolution. Let them eat cake, she said. How will these people view the president, who brought nothing but pain and worry to them? Do you want to bet that there will not be another shutdown during Trump's term? Hey, put money on it. Trump revealed to his base supporters that he was in over his head by ordering a fruitless shutdown. It won't happen again anytime soon. Bet on it. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The same Nancy Pelosi who's deprecating the Green New Deal or something like that. Well, just had kind of a bombshell off of a text, and I'm trying to figure it out, so I guess I better return to the plan here. Behind the News comes up with a repeat of an interesting story about Germany in the 60s. The Bader-Meinhof gang and all that stuff. Here's Amy, and not surprisingly, it's about what she's been covering a bit this week, more than a bit. Quite well, it seems to me, the whole blackface thing. Someone she had on the show said that they can make arrangements to have an interim position that would then go to election the next election cycle, which I haven't heard on any media. It's all like, well, does it go all the way down to the Republican recalcitrant or retrograde guy? This is in Virginia, where the House is controlled by one vote by the Republicans, and it was one with a flip of the coin, because it was like a tie or something. I can't remember the details of that. You can't make this stuff up.
Blackface, racism, politics, and pain. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 400 years ago, in August 1619, the slave ship White Lion moored at Point Comfort on the James River in Virginia and deposited its human cargo, the first enslaved Africans brought to what would become the United States. Four centuries later, on the first day of Black History Month, the white governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, was answering questions about whether or not he wore blackface while in medical school. Northam's personal page in the 1984 Eastern Virginia Medical School yearbook included a photo with two people, one man in blackface standing next to another person in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. Northam first said he may have been one of the two in the photo. The next day, in a news conference, he denied being in the photo and defied growing calls for him to resign as governor.
I am not either of the people in that photo,
said Governor Northam with his wife at his side. Later in a statement, he did admit,
that same year, I did participate in a dance contest in San Antonio, in which I darkened my face as part of a Michael Jackson costume. I look back now and regret that I did not understand the harmful legacy of an action like that.
Governor Northam is not the only politician recently confronted with blackface in his past. Florida Secretary of State Michael Ertel resigned on January 28th after just 2 weeks in office when photos surfaced of him from a 2005 Halloween party. Ertel was in blackface dressed as a woman with a shirt that read, Katrina victim, just over 2 months after the Category 5 hurricane devastated New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, killing thousands of people, disproportionately the poor and people of color.
Amateur blackface minstrelsy was the number one entertainment form throughout the 19th century and the 20th century.
That's Raylan Barnes speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. The Princeton professor's forthcoming book is titled Darkology, When the American Dream Wore Blackface. She went on describing the role of women in combating the practice of blackface in U.S. society.
Everyday black mothers during the civil rights movement in the 1950s and the 1960s fought to shut down blackface and said, this is unacceptable. They worked with the NAACP and said, we need to outlaw this so that it's no longer in our schools, it's no longer in government spaces. And there was a lot of pushback to these black mothers, especially from the men in the civil rights movement who said, we need to focus on voting rights. We need to focus on anti-lynching. And these black mothers said, no, my son was lynched because of these stereotypes, because of these grotesque representations that objectify African Americans. This is the thing of the thing, the seed of the seed, that allows racism to thrive in America, and it needs to be stopped. And they were successful. And so because of that success, blackface has become so taboo that most Americans don't know the through line of how and why these stereotypes were transmitted to us.
That's Princeton University professor Raylan Barnes. The calls from Democrats for Northam to resign were almost universal, from the Virginia Democratic Party to former Democratic governors of the state to the Commonwealth's two current U.S. senators to organizations that long supported him, like the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. PPFA's new president, Dr. Lena Wen, said in a statement, Governor Northam is also Dr. Northam. As a physician myself, I thought a lot about what this means for him to appear like this during medical school and how that reflects on the patient care he and his classmates might provide, Dr. Wen said. The same 1984 yearbook from Eastern Virginia Medical School had at least two other photos of white students in blackface. The school stopped producing yearbooks after the 2013 edition, which included three photos of students dressed as Confederate soldiers in front of the Confederate battle flag.
I want to express my sincere apologies, particularly to the African American communities.
That's Eastern Virginia Medical School President Richard Holman speaking on Tuesday. Racist attitudes like those expressed in the yearbooks might help explain why African-American patients in the United States are actually given fewer pain-killing medications than white patients. A 2016 University of Virginia study found that a substantial number of white medical students and residents hold, quote, beliefs about biological differences between blacks and whites, beliefs dating back to slavery, associated with the perception that black people feel less pain than do white people, the study concluded. On Wednesday, Virginia's Attorney General, Democrat Mark Herring, admitted that he, too, wore blackface at a 1980 college party at the University of Virginia. This in the same state, on the same university campus, where hundreds of white supremacists, Klansmen, and neo-Nazis marched less than 2 years ago in Charlottesville, attacking counter-protesters and killing one of them. The legacy of slavery in the United States lives on in countless, often deadly ways. Racism, like the shoe polish Governor Northam used on his face, can't simply be scrubbed away. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah. I had some arguments about this on Facebook this week. Maybe I lost an acquaintance in the process. Well, look into Cakewalk, too. This is where whites picked up the things they were lampooning, I guess. This is house slaves competing over by performing. It's pretty untold story, I think. Well, somebody's probably written on it, but and I don't know that much about it, really, except some passing talk show about it or something. Okay, here's segment from The Intercepted, the latest one. Includes, eventually, we'll get to some Vijay Prashad, and less than I thought I was going to get on. He's talking about three major subjects, but all in terms of U.S. imperial dominance, it seems to me. Perils of dominance. Then, before I get to the Prashad, I'll be playing this essay from, or a reportage from Sarah Lazar and a colleague of hers in Chicago about the Chicago Police Department. It'll be a little different. It's voiced by a guy that does the podcasts for The Intercepted, where they read the articles. It's a pretty amazing story, and it hits us close to where we live. As I mentioned, Urbana was getting its crisis intervention training from Chicagoland. Not as good as many places it could be. Maybe it isn't being done with them anymore. Go to Memphis, where they have an exemplary program. Okay, I'll try and work in another local announcement. But here's and I don't understand the reference of this lampoon, but it sounds like Trump is tardy or absent.
Axios says a White House source leaked President Trump's private schedule. While the schedule does not show all of Mr. Trump's meetings, it indicates he has spent about 60% of his time in unstructured executive time. Axios sources say much of that.
Adams.
Here.
Adam Lee.
Here.
Adamowski. Adamson.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Donald Trump. Trump? Trump? Trump?
He's sick. My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who stopped pass out at 31 Flavors last night.
We join our neighbors in the Gulf.
Extraordinary.
For comp time.
The President of the United States gets on television tonight and says the economy is great.
Because you're fake news. You don't report it.
The union address, and the president, I understand, Kellyanne, will have a theme. A theme will be to stop the resistance. Will it resonate?
Well, he has several themes, but I would characterize his overall as visionary.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 81 of Intercepted.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
It's always difficult to know where to begin with these Trump states of the union. I guess we should just jump right in. I mean, one of the moments that I found to be most bizarre through the night was Trump as he praised the record number of women elected to Congress.
Don't sit yet. You're gonna like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
The Democratic women, most of whom dressed in all white, began cheering and dancing in the aisles. Within moments, it seemed like all of Congress was chanting, USA, USA.
That's great. Really great. And congratulations. That's great.
It was an astonishing moment as Trump stood there basking in the applause, the chanting, the dancing, and imagining his greatness. With everything we know about Trump, about Donald Trump and women, the whole thing just felt, well, it was disturbing. Anyway, Trump also drew big bipartisan applause for his Venezuela remarks, where he openly threatened regime change. A bunch of Democrats joined in the standing ovation.
2 weeks ago, the United States officially recognized the legitimate government of Venezuela and its new president, Juan Guaido. Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
This is a dangerous statement. It's akin to the same sentiments that we heard coming out of Germany as Hitler rose to power. It's indicative of a campaign to malign his political enemies and to do so in the name of defending America. Yes, there are socialist groups and movements in the United States. Yes, there are the Democratic Socialists. Yes, a handful of them have won congressional seats. But what Trump is doing here is preparing a line of justification for the intensifying of red baiting and McCarthyism. And it was sickening to watch some Democrats join the Republicans in standing for applause as Trump made these incendiary comments. We are definitely going to return to those remarks and that moment on future episodes of the show.
We've rammed in your harbor and tied to your port, and our pistols are hungry and our tempers are short. So bring your daughters around to the fore, 'cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
That is the late, great Phil Oakes with his song Cops of the World. And of course, Donald Trump loves cops. Cops love Donald Trump. But what about the most lethal cops in the world? The ones that Phil Oakes was singing about. The cops who police and brutalize and kill people across the globe. The cops who tell other countries what they can and can't do and crush those who don't obey. The cops who punish people for electing the wrong candidate or nationalizing the oil. What about the cops of the U.S. empire? You see, we're constantly told how Donald Trump is at war with the deep state, how the CIA and FBI and U.S. military, they're filled with people secretly, quietly, protecting democracy, protecting all of us from the dangers of unhinged Trump. And part of this story of Trump at war with the intelligence community makes sense. I mean, Trump did compare the CIA to the Nazis.
I think it's a disgrace. And I say that, and I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace.
Trump spends endless executive time not reading intelligence reports. He wants cartoons instead of analysis. And he uses phrases like the intelligence people when disagreeing with reports he also admits to having not read.
I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years. Could be 8 years, but 8 years.
But hit pause on the Trump show for a moment. Take a breath and look at the bigger picture. Trump is actually great for the shadow bureaucracy at Langley, the NSA, at the Pentagon. He's good for the America is the cops of the world crowd. The unelected power brokers who run the national security establishment have constantly had to fight with elected leaders. They don't want limits. They don't want supervision. They don't want oversight. They want to be left to do what they believe is necessary to protect their version of American national security. Trump is, in many ways, a godsend. He tells them to torture if they have to. Kill civilians if you believe it's necessary. Hell, let's even consider sending heads of state that the CIA hates to Guantanamo. That's what John Bolton recently suggested.
Well, I tweeted yesterday, I wish him a long, quiet retirement on a pretty beach far from Venezuela. And the sooner he takes advantage of that, the sooner he's likely to have a nice, quiet retirement on a pretty beach rather than being in some other beach area like Guantanamo.
For all of the huffing and puffing about Trump being at odds with the CIA or the so-called intelligence community, Trump is actually the very kind of president that the most unsavory forces in the U.S. arsenal love. Why? Because Trump mostly doesn't care what they do. He certainly isn't going to talk about shattering the CIA into a million little pieces. He's not going to support Congress investigating U.S. involvement with coups, dirty tricks, extrajudicial killings. He likes those things. He wants more of that. In many ways, we're in a new golden era for the CIA and black ops war planners. On the question of Trump's style versus more traditional adult administrations, journalist Alan Nairn said the following on last week's Intercepted.
Trump versus the establishment. They both agree first that the U.S. has the right to essentially extend the Monroe Doctrine to the entire globe and say the entire globe is the U.S. backyard, and that the U.S. has the right to invade anywhere at any time for any reason. And secondly, that in doing so, the U.S. has the right to kill civilians in those countries with no repercussions. The only difference they have is a tactical one. The Trump people say, go in, invade wherever you want, but do it absolutely without restraint, but get it over with quickly.
The CIA and the military, they can wait out any administration that comes to power with an idea about reining them in. They were pretty adept at scaring and managing Barack Obama.
I also have a belief that we need to look forward as opposed to looking backwards. And part of my job is to make sure that, for example, at the CIA, you've got extraordinarily talented people who are working very hard to keep Americans safe. I don't want them to suddenly feel like they've got to spend all their time looking over their shoulders.
This national security shadow state can play the game, wax the wheels, and get by until another Bush or a Cheney comes along. Trump is certainly an anomaly, and an unpredictable one at that. Cheney wanted to micromanage the CIA and U.S. Special Operations Forces. Trump doesn't know enough about the world, or about intelligence, or how government functions to do what Cheney did. But the end result is pretty much the same. Cheney empowered these forces through management and constant pressure, including literally going to the CIA to instruct them on how to cook the books on intelligence. Trump empowers these forces through offering them carte blanche power with little to no questioning, as long as it doesn't make him look personally bad. As long as this remains true, Trump can whine about the deep state all he wants. He can even call them Nazis. He can tweet his disagreements with their assessments. But in reality, Donald Trump is generally good for their dirty business.
What would make you use the U.S. military in Venezuela? What's a national
security interest? Well, I don't want to say that, but certainly it's something that's on the, it's an option.
And that brings us to Venezuela. The open push for regime change, the recognizing of opposition leader Juan Guaido as the so-called legitimate president, the sanctions aimed at starving the population into submission. All of these are straight out of the CIA playbook of the 1950s and 60s. It was what the U.S. tried to do with the blockade against Cuba over the course of many decades.
Following Premier Castro's rejection of UN inspections, White House Press Secretary Pierre Salinger announces resumption of the naval blockade and of aerial surveillance of the missile sites. They'd been suspended until UN Acting Secretary General U Thant returned from his talks with the Cuban dictator.
What we are seeing right now in Latin America is a modern iteration of the same dirty tactics that the U.S. has historically used against the nations south of the U.S. border. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. The U.S. has tried since the early 2000s to overthrow its socialist government, beginning with Hugo Chavez. At the same time, it's poured money into right-wing movements and backed open fascists like Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. All of this is a modern version of the era of overthrowing leftists who won at the ballot box or by overthrowing U.S.-friendly dictators. And all of the mass murder, the sanctions, the regime change, the election interference, the covert support for anti-democratic forces determined to be good for so-called free markets is today, as it was in the 1950s, sold in the name of bringing freedom and democracy.
The future of civilization depends on what we do, on what we do now.
If we withdrew from Vietnam, the communists would control Vietnam.
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain her independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other
nations. All over the Pacific, in the Mideast, in Europe, in the world, the United States would suffer a blow. And peace, because we are the great peacekeeping nation in the world today because of our power.
For several years now, under two administrations, the United States has been increasing its defense of freedom in the Caribbean basin. And I can tell you tonight, democracy is beginning to take root in El Salvador.
At this moment, U.S. forces
including forces deployed from the United States last night, are engaged in action in Panama.
Their mission is to attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. Their purpose is to protect the national interest of the United States.
To disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Last night, on my orders, America's armed forces began strikes against ISIL targets in Syria.
My administration has also imposed tough sanctions on the communist and socialist dictatorships in Cuba and Venezuela.
Powerful Democrats and Republicans alike have sold the notion that economic sanctions are somehow a cleaner way of forcing change than military force. They portray sanctions as targeting the dictators, the oligarchs, the criminally corrupt. But the filthy truth is that not all sanctions are created equal. Yes, there are sanctions that do go after individual criminals. But the sanctions we're talking about on Venezuela right now, they're not going to harm Nicolas Maduro and his inner circle personally. No, these sanctions are aimed at punishing the Venezuelan people by depriving them of food, of medicine, of wages, of their very humanity. The strategy is to use these sanctions as a cudgel against an already suffering people in a campaign to torture them into submission. Now, don't take my word for it. The former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, William Brownfield, has been aggressively lobbying for more sanctions, saying, quote, perhaps the best solution would be to accelerate the collapse. He says this while actually openly acknowledging that sanctions will kill innocent people, increase malnutrition, and bring, quote, fairly severe punishment for millions and millions of Venezuelans.
And if we can do something that will bring that end quicker, we probably should do it. But we should do it understanding that it's going to have an impact on millions and millions of people who are already having great difficulty finding enough to eat, getting themselves cured when they get sick, or are finding clothes to put on their children before they go off to school. We don't get to do this and pretend as though it has no impact there. We have to make the hard decision. The desired outcome justifies this fairly severe punishment.
Now, let's be clear here. This is the former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela speaking at a Washington, D.C. think tank, publicly saying that it is worth the price of the lives and health and humanity of ordinary Venezuelans in order to overthrow a government that the U.S. does not like.
Today, Treasury took action against Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, to help prevent the further diversion of Venezuela's assets by former President Maduro.
These sanctions are going to cost Venezuela $11 billion in oil revenue in 2019 alone. That amounts to nearly 95% of the money that Venezuela spent on the import of food and other goods last year. This isn't targeting Maduro. Even The Economist magazine stated the following about the logic behind the sanctions, and I'm quoting here. Mr. Guaido and Mr. Trump are betting that hardship will topple the regime before it starves the Venezuelan people. That's not Hugo Chavez speaking from the grave. That's The Economist magazine. So let's be clear. This is targeting ordinary people in order to strangle them into bowing down to Washington's agenda. And Ambassador Brownfield's sick advocacy of punishing ordinary Venezuelans to impose the U.S. agenda is reminiscent of how Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, defended the murderous sanctions against Iraq in the 1990s.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
When powerful political leaders in the U.S. want to change governments, the price of killing innocent people is always worth it. It's the American way. And this is why Trump is being embraced on his Venezuela policy. He is promoting and advancing the bipartisan politics of empire. It's the same dynamic when the so-called adults on Capitol Hill support giving Trump sweeping surveillance powers or unending funds for an already insane military spending budget. For all the screaming about Trump being a grave threat to democracy, worst president ever, an unhinged maniac, when he boosts the policies of imperialism, he gets to be part of the club of the cops of the world.
'Cause we're the cops of the world, boy.
Wow. Gosh, I should have let Phil Oakes sing a little longer there. That's Jeremy Scahill with an opinion piece crafted at the Intercept Studios. And we're going to move right along. I mentioned the ACLU event at the animations and the presence of one of the people whose story is animated in this nationwide screening of these animations about the mass incarceration. It's Tuesday at 7 o'clock at the Art Theater, and there is indeed a discussion afterwards. I still haven't found out who are the discussants locally. So this again is an article written for The Intercept, but voiced by their spoken word operators, as it were. I don't know. And it's about cops of Chicago. Little lame thematic connection there. And do a lot of more national issues as opposed to international issues. But when you're the imperial overlord, I guess everything's both. And let's see how this goes here. Let's see. Let's we mentioned the Art Theater. Oh, there's a new class coming up. Airshifter training on Sunday, February 17th. So you have time to figure that out. Airshifter training at WEF.org is the email, if you want to do it that way. I'm sure there's some information on the website, but you can also do the phone thing, maybe even text this number. I guess that would work. 217-778-1664, new glasses. And that's Vicky, who does the bulk of the training cooperatively, though. All right, Behind the News is coming up in just 24 minutes. Let's see how this sounds in this particular playback. If you listen to podcasts, you know, probably don't listen to them in real time, unless it's about music, I suppose.
Welcome to the Spoken Edition of The Intercept.
Officers accused of abuses are leading Chicago Police's Implicit Bias Training Program by Debbie Southorn and Sarah Lazar. Sergio Herrera, a Chicago police officer, was accused in a 2010 lawsuit of teaming up with another officer to mace and beat a black man for no reason. The man was sitting in his parked car when Herrera's colleague approached the vehicle. As the man went to retrieve his identification, the officer told him to cuff up, at which point Herrera entered the fray, spraying the man with mace, according to the lawsuit. Both officers then allegedly proceeded to throw the man to the ground, strike him in the head with handcuffs, and dig their knees into his back. When the man asked for medical assistance, his pleas were ignored. Instead, the police took him to the station. The lawsuit charges that the man's ribs were fractured and that he was left with permanent injuries as a result of the incident. The city of Chicago ended up paying the victim a settlement of $75,000 without admitting wrongdoing. Out-of-court settlements for civil rights violations are a common outcome for the department, which is plagued by lawsuits. Now, Herrera has a new assignment, to be one of several officers who oversee the Chicago Police Department's Implicit Bias Trainings, a program intended to curb incidents of racist police violence. Herrera's role is part of a troubling pattern. The trainings are a key part of the city's efforts to reform its notoriously abusive police force, but revamped trainings that debuted in 2017 have in many cases been overseen by some of the alleged abusers themselves. 16 of the 17 police officers, excluding only Officer Angela McLaurin, who have provided instruction for the procedural justice training program since the start of 2017, have together garnered a total of 111 misconduct complaints, according to police documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. The misconduct complaints range from false arrests to illegal searches and include use of excessive force, often against people of color, in Chicago. One officer who provided training has faced 7 accusations of mistreating black people since 2011. 6 other officers have together been accused of abuses in at least 10 civil rights lawsuits, with at least half of those cases resulting in settlements or payments to the plaintiffs. Over the past 2 years, the Chicago Police Department has aggressively marched forward on expanding the quantity and quality of in-service training available to officers, said Sergeant Cindy Guerra of the Chicago Police's Office of the Superintendent in a statement to The Intercept. By incorporating national best practices, CPD's revised training supports officers' abilities to be successful in the performance of their duties and ensures sustainable reform, Guerra, who declined to speak to the outcomes of legal cases, added. All allegations made against a Chicago police officer are taken seriously and thoroughly investigated. For activists working on policing issues in Chicago, the track records of police officers who have or are giving trainings underscore the problems with pushing for improved training as the solution for police violence. The urgency around policing is valid and real, but the insistence that what we need is better training is leading to massive amounts of money to an already overinflated arsenal and budget of CPD. Paige May, co-founder of Asata's Daughters, a collective of black women in Chicago who identify their work as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, told The Intercept. The trainings were instituted in the wake of a massive public relations crisis for the Chicago Police Department and Mayor Rahm Emanuel. The 2014 police killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald and subsequent cover-up by city officials pushed policing issues to the fore in the city, leading to protests and eventually a damning 2017 Department of Justice investigation. In response, the police department pledged to reform itself, in part by providing better internal trainings with an emphasis on addressing implicit bias. The Chicago Police Department followed up with a report last April outlining its next steps for reform. The department, which has a pattern of racist harassment, civil rights violations, and unreasonable killings, according to the Department of Justice, trumpeted its plan as a solution to public concerns. The 2018 Next Steps for Reform framework is our continued promise to the communities we serve that CPD is serious about addressing the historical challenges we face, Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson said at the time. The police plan emphasized its procedural justice training program as a key component of its reform strategy. One of the courses in the training program will focus on implicit bias, or the pervasive and deep-seated prejudices that shape behavior, the police report says. While the department has shared little public information about the content of these trainings, a sympathetic article in the Chicago Sun-Times billed it as a sensitivity training course, noting that the term procedural justice is a popular buzzword among police departments under scrutiny for patterns of racist violence. According to the Chicago Police Department report, all officers are mandated to complete the entire training series by the end of 2020. Stomping a black man. Many of the instructors who have taught their fellow police officers how to deal with biases, however, are trailed by a litany of civilian complaints. 11 of the 17 officers who have provided procedural justice training since the start of 2017 have been accused of violating the rights of black people, and 9 have been accused 2 times or more of mistreating black people, according to public information collected by the Citizens Police Data Project, a project of the journalism nonprofit Invisible Institute and the University of Chicago Law School's Mandel Legal Aid Clinic. The number may be low. Many of the civilian complaints against these officers did not note the race of the complainants. Only 3 of the 111 complaints of misconduct were sustained in the processes that adjudicate these complaints, but that comes amid a system that infrequently holds cops to account. Fewer than 2% of misconduct accusations against Chicago police officers are sustained, a low rate, according to the Department of Justice. Responding to a question from The Intercept about the complaints against 4 of the officers who have provided trainings, Guerra, the police spokesperson, said, in reference to the 4 officers you mentioned, none of these officers have any sustained allegations against them. The Intercept requested comment on and interviews with the 5 officers named in the story for having participated in trainings while also having records of civilian complaints or civil rights lawsuits. Some of these alleged attacks were violent. According to one civilian complaint obtained through a FOIA request, one of the officers who has provided trainings, Officer Daniel Getz, allegedly stomped a black man while he was prostrate on the ground outside a Shell station in October 2015. The man had attracted the police's attention simply for urinating outdoors after he was turned away from the gas station bathroom. When the police asked the man to approach their car, he fled. The officers who were with Getz threatened bystanders for attempting to document the alleged injustice, according to the complaint. Witnesses approached to film the police's actions but were allegedly warned by the accused officer that if they video recorded anything, the man would be punished more severely. In Illinois, it is illegal to record most police interactions with the public. A medical report noted bruising to the victim's left side and that he sought medical care on 2 separate occasions as a result. The Independent Police Review Authority investigator noted the witnesses declined to testify, and after fellow police officers denied the accusations against Getz, the complaint process halted, with the evidence deemed insufficient to prove or disprove the allegations. In his statement, the Chicago police indicated that Getz is not currently giving procedural justice trainings, though he was listed in an FOIA document as one of the individuals who had done so since the start of 2017. In another civilian complaint also obtained through a FOIA request, Getz was accused of grabbing a black man by the arm before another officer allegedly said, "I will lock your black fucking ass up." That complaint also was not sustained after the officers who were present denied the allegations. The civil rights lawsuits against 6 of the officers who have provided training are even more harrowing, particularly those involving Wasim Saeed, a Chicago police officer since 2002 who has been employed in the department's education and training division. Like Getz, the police indicated in their statement to The Intercept that Saeed was not currently giving procedural justice trainings. In one suit from 2008, Saeed was accused of participating in a police raid on a home in which officers pointed their guns at the heads of an adult with a heart condition, a 6-year-old child, and a 4-month-old infant. The 6-year-old began to vomit as a result of defendant's actions, the lawsuit alleges, noting that no criminal charges were ultimately filed. The case settled with $35,000 awarded to the plaintiffs. According to a separate lawsuit filed the same year, Saeed and another officer responded violently to an alleged physical assault of a young girl by an adult woman. The suit charges that the officer slammed the girl's head extremely hard onto the hood of a car and held her there despite pleas from her mother that she was only 10 years old. The following morning, the child received treatment at a hospital for neck strain and head trauma, alleges the lawsuit, which resulted in a dismissal. Saeed is not alone. In 2007, Officer Reginald Weatherly was sued for his alleged participation in a group beating. One or more of defendant officers repeatedly struck plaintiff in the leg with a blackjack club, breaking his ankle and causing plaintiff severe pain and suffering, according to the suit. The suit, which resulted in settlement and dismissal, states that the other officers named in the suit had the opportunity to intervene to prevent it but failed to do so. In its statement to The Intercept, the Chicago Police Department indicated that Weatherly was not currently giving procedural justice trainings. Beyond formal charges, the social media conduct of at least one of the police trainers raises further cause for concern. An officer named Phil Weiser, who also serves as an instructor of the procedural justice training, published Facebook posts that include images and rhetoric associated with Blue Lives Matter, a reactionary movement that arose in opposition to Black Lives Matter. One of his profile photos, updated on December 23, 2015, when Chicago was in the grips of protests responding to the release of the Laquan McDonald shooting video, shows an image of a group of officers in riot gear that reads, "Sometimes there's justice, sometimes there's just us." This image, along with other profile photos depicting the thin blue line, the mantra that police are the only thing separating society from chaos, demonstrates an affinity with precisely the us versus them mentality Weiser has been tasked with eradicating. Guerra, the Chicago police spokesperson, told The Intercept, "As part of our commitment to improved and expanded in-service training under the consent decree, impartial policing concepts to include proper use of social media will be provided for all officers, including supervisors and command staff." Yet the promise of improved trainings given by police, despite the fact that most of the officers who have given trainings faced formal accusations of troubling misconduct, is being used to justify the funneling of public funds into the police department. In his budget for 2018, Emanuel cited the need for best practice training for officers and supervisors. He called for $103.5 million worth of new investments in police and first responders. Joey Mogul, a partner at the People's Law Office who represents victims of police torture, told The Intercept that the troubling track records of these police officers show that the department cannot train its way out of a crisis of public legitimacy. "The issues we have with the CPD and several municipal police departments are not only willful and egregious violations of the law, but officers coming together to cover those things up," Mogul said. Mogul cited the case of Jason Van Dyke, the officer who was convicted last October of second-degree murder for killing McDonald. Notably, Van Dyke was trained at the police academy and had been awarded 22 honorable mentions over his career, in addition to having a long list of misconduct complaints. In the case of Van Dyke, what additional training did that officer need in order to not go out and shoot and kill someone like Laquan McDonald the way he did, Mogul said. "Look at the officers who went out of their way and made false statements. They could tell from looking at the video that they were false statements. What training did those officers need to tell them you can't lie?"
They've had a lot of training to the contrary. That's from The Intercept, and it's penned by Sarah Lazar and a colleague. I guess maybe they have a cooperative relationship with in these times out of Chicago to publish that. The guy that does the Invisible Institute, James Clavin, writes for The Intercept too, but I don't think he's penned anything in a while. The top of the hour, I was talking about, just in passing, about the Bezos thing, extortion, where did they get the sex texts? The article in the business press of the New York Times was actually on January 15th. It was under my radar for a while. And somebody did point out today on Weekend Edition that kind of after you've revealed some of them, you don't have much leverage anymore. What, they're just going to send some more out? So if they do find out what happened and whether the IC, intelligence community, was involved in getting these transcripts, they just went over the Saudi stuff and got the Khashoggi threat from Majesty Bonesaw, MBS. So anyway, all right, go-to guy Vijay Prashad, interviewed here by Jeremy Scahill, going back to the audio, the real audio version, the interview audio version of The Intercepted, and I just play the first 12 minutes and pledge that you can find it by looking for The Intercepted podcast. The other segment is this Peter Moss, who I think used to write for The Village Voice when there was one. In the Village and elsewhere, talking about Reality Winner. And I guess there's a play dramatizing the transcript of the interview with her, and there's some readings of it in this piece. He's a hard-boiled New York City journalist, but I guess he's looking at, in terms of what the FBI can get away with if they do this kind of collegial approach that they seem to have done, as documented in this segment from The Intercepted. Listen to the very end, to see about conclusions, etc., and what his... he's been actually following it for a while. Anyway, only 10 minutes left, and then behind the news, I guess Gina might be doing continuity, though Barb T is here in the house doing some work, so I can turn it over, turn the airwaves over to behind the news. WEFT Champaign-Urbana. We'll just hear this 10-minute segment. I guess this is a teaser for The Intercepted.
World, boys, we're the cops of the world.
Joining me now to discuss the state of imperialism in the world, the situation in Venezuela, the upcoming elections in India, and the recent one in the Democratic Republic of Congo is Vijay Prashad. He is an Indian historian, editor, and journalist. He's also a writing fellow and chief correspondent at Globetrotter. That's a project of the Independent Media Institute. Vijay is the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and the chief editor of Left Word Books. Vijay is a prolific writer, authoring 25 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. Vijay Prashad, welcome to Intercepted.
Thank you so much.
You recently wrote that what happened to Chile in 1973, when there was a U.S.-initiated coup against the democratically elected leader Salvador Allende, that that is precisely what the United States has attempted to do in many countries of the global South. And you say the most recent target for the U.S. government and Western big business is Venezuela. What are the parallels that you see between the overthrow of Allende in 1973 and what we're seeing now with the push to overthrow Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela?
I'm glad we're starting here, Jeremy, because this is really the most important issue, I think, of our period, which is, you know, this very extravagant set of claims made by particularly the United States and its closest allies about countries in the global South, whether it's Iran or Venezuela or a host of other countries. Let's think about the Chilean example. In 1970, when Salvador Allende was coming close to winning a very legitimate election to come to office, the United States government said, we will not tolerate it if people like Allende decide to nationalize, you know, resources. In the case of Chile, it was copper.
American companies dominated the Chilean economy. Oil companies, the telephone company, and 80% of the country's copper industry, Chile's biggest source of revenue. Allende's program called for putting big business in Chilean hands.
And so they began to plan to, in a way, undermine Allende through barricading his economy long before Allende even won the election. And after he won the election, they did everything possible to prevent Chile from selling copper outside its boundaries and therefore bankrupting Chile, creating distress within the country, and then winking to the military to take over. And by the way, Chile is not the beginning of this. We saw this in 1953 in Guatemala, where the issue was the nationalization of the United Fruit Company.
Thousands of communists and fellow travelers are rounded up in makeshift prisons. For United Fruit, it's business as usual, as all company land seized by the communists is returned.
In Iran, the issue was oil.
Appearances, Mohammad Mossadegh, Premier of Iran, meets the press to reaffirm his government's unwillingness to arbitrate with Britain over nationalizing the Anglo-Iranian oil company.
The government of Mohammad Mossadegh nationalized the oil company. This was something seen as totally inappropriate by Western oil companies, the so-called Seven Sisters, and the United States, in alliance with Great Britain, conducted a coup against Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran and against Jacob Arbenz in Guatemala. I mean, there's so many examples of precisely this situation. With Venezuela, you know, this is a country that has never been able to diversify its economy. About 98% of its external revenues comes from oil and from petroleum products. You know, in the last few years, oil prices have collapsed by 50%, which means that Venezuela's external revenues have also collapsed by about 50%. Rather than help the Venezuelans, what we begin to see is the Obama administration in 2015 declaring Venezuela a national security threat, and now the Trump administration, with the very close help of Mr. Trudeau from Canada, trying to essentially overthrow the government of Mr. Nicolas Maduro.
You know, I, of course, agree with your analysis on the U.S. intervention, but we are seeing millions of Venezuelans over the past several years fleeing the country. Yes, the opposition, some elements of the opposition to Maduro have killed people. At the same time, Maduro controls most of the state mechanisms of organized violence, the police, the military, etc. And we have seen real brutality and lethal force used over and over on the opposition. My question for you is, and I, you know, I've been hearing this from Venezuelans who say, look, we are not Trump supporters, but Maduro is running the country into the ground. Yes, we understand sanctions, everything Vijay is saying, we agree with that. At the same time, Maduro has built himself a kleptocracy. Are you saying that there is no legitimacy whatsoever to any sector of the opposition against Maduro right now?
Well, look, let's put it this way. There are obvious problems. As I said, when your revenues decline to almost 50%, you're going to suffer great problems inside the country. You've got an economic stranglehold by the sanctions regime and so on. Yes, there are Venezuelans fleeing the country, but, you know, Jeremy, there are 69 million people who have been displaced around the world, and that's a very conservative figure, largely displaced because of the very structural policies that are, you know, are disturbing countries, not only Venezuela, but countries across West Africa, in Central Asia. You have wars, you have economic policies that are displacing people. So, of course, there are people moving. Of course, there are people who feel that this government is not representing them. But that's what the political process is about. I mean, are we saying that Nicolas Maduro is a dictator? Now, in the last election, which the opposition only partly boycotted, he only won 67% of the vote. The opposition is politically divided. It's not able to come together. One section of the opposition has turned to the United States and said, essentially, give us a hand to use any means to overthrow this guy. Why don't you build the opposition? On any day in Caracas, Jeremy, you open the newspapers. They're all deeply critical of the Maduro government. If this is a dictatorship, I don't understand what freedom, you know, in our limited sense is. You know, he gets hammered on television. He's getting hammered on the newspapers. The fact is the opposition is not able to come together. And the deep residues of Chavista loyalty to the Maduro government, but also to the institutions of the missions and so on, is not to be set aside. In other words, you have this very loyal section of Chavistas who are committed to the Bolivarian Revolution. They understand the problems. They're willing to fight to defend the government, and they come out in large numbers to vote for the government. But yet their large numbers, as I said, amount to 67%. There is a political process. Maduro has said, let's go back. Let's have a negotiation. Let's think about a new election. The Venezuelan government in this last election last year asked the United Nations to send monitors. Why did the United Nations not send monitors? You know, why is the United States government attempting to cripple the political process in Venezuela to create the preconditions where you can then think there's nothing else to be done except U.S. intervention to anoint somebody as the president? A deeply undemocratic act.
Vijay Prashad. I didn't know about that. Business about the United Nations observers not being sent, even though they were asked for. Dimension that I haven't seen a